This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Mahaparinibbana Sutra. While staying on Vulture Peak Mountain, the Blessed One often gave this Dharma talk to the students. Such is virtue, such is concentration, such is discernment. Concentration nurtured with virtue is of great fruit, great reward. Discernment nurtured with concentration is of great fruit, great reward. The mind nurtured with discernment is rightly released from the effluence, the effluent of sensuality, of becoming, and delusion. When we were in India recently, one of the things I most wanted to experience that we couldn't was the rainy season, because it wasn't the rainy season. And to know what it was like for the Buddha to have been alive and teaching and developing his Sangha with that kind of cycle of seasons and of such sort of pronounced season. I asked Tosan, who was leading our group, if he'd ever taken a group during the monsoon season. He said, no. And I said, how come? And he goes, because you can't, it's very hard to travel. Roads are become impassable. Certainly at the Buddha's time, rivers would have been very hard to cross. So they settled down. And we went to, I think it was Vaisali, where he spent about 25 rainy seasons, angos, and which was more than anywhere else. And of course, none of the original structures were there, which would have all been built with wood. So in their place were built mostly of brick, sandstone. But to be in that place where he spent so many seasons and where the Sangha gathered, just as we gather each spring and fall, and to be in the place where it was thought was where his hut was, his house, or his structure, the building that was built for him to stay in, and what would that have looked like? And to think of what, kept thinking of what is it, how does it affect one's consciousness to be in that country experiencing those cycle of seasons, just as what is it for us in North America, and what part of North America you may live in, to experience this landscape, these cycles of season, how does that affect us, the way we sort of experience our senses and see the world. And I have to think that it affects us deeply, even if we don't know how. And in this final sutra of the Buddha's, which we were studying while we were traveling, this comes up quite a bit. You know, what's interesting to me about that sutra is it's because it's the Buddha's final days, he knows he's dying. He knows he is going to, he has already chosen the time of his death. He's communicated to Mara that in 3 months' time, he will die. And so he's traveling. The sutra is really an account of his traveling to different places where the different clusters of the Sangha were. And in each place he goes, he does a teaching. And then when he feels that that's completed, then he'll say to Ananda, now let's go to such and such a place. And then they'll walk to the next place. And similarly, in this talk, which it says he gave often, repeats itself in the sutra. Such is virtue, such is concentration, such is discernment. And so he's as he often does in his teaching, he's drawing a relationship between these different aspects of practice. So that's what I wanted to look at, that fundamentally all things have one essence. And in the differences, Nothing is separated. Nothing is divided. And so when we practice, in any given moment, we may be aware of one thing. We may be drawing upon one quality. Maybe we need to draw upon patience because we're feeling impatience, or perseverance because we want to give up, or spirit because we feel apathetic. And in that moment, that quality may seem singular or, you know, sort of alone. But what the Buddha makes clear, and what we have to know, because things are not divided fundamentally, is that we're never just focusing on one thing. In the same way that we can focus on one aspect of the Eightfold Path or one aspect of the Eight Gates. And our attention is given over to that one thing, but in fact, within us, all of those are present and being touched and being brought forth. The teaching of dependent origination is perhaps one of the most complete or sophisticated examples of that, where each aspect of that cycle, beginning with delusion and ending up in sickness, old age, and death and suffering, that each aspect is the requisite condition for the next aspect, that nothing stands alone. Everything is dependent, exists in a state of dependency on everything else. And so here the Buddha speaks of virtue, that when such is virtue, and that virtue is of concentration nurtured with virtue, is of great fruit, great reward. And virtue is maybe for many of us a little, may feel a little archaic or sort of not really in our ordinary vernacular. But so we can think of it as just to live within virtue is to live within harmony, to live in a way that's true, to not create disharmony, discord, conflict, suffering, and to be in, which means to be in harmony with our nature, our body and mind, our thoughts and emotions, our experiences, the bodies and minds of others, the inanimate world. To live a virtuous life is to live a non-harming life. It's to live an awake life. And so we have the precepts that guide us in what we need to really pay particular attention to. Those 10 great precepts are the ways in which we create the most binding karma. And the other side of each of those precepts is each precept is how do we create what Buddhism calls non-virtue, and then how do we bring forth virtue? It's the other side of that. So greed transforms into generosity, anger into compassion. And so our vows, our metta practices, cultivating compassion, Avalokiteshvara, Samantabhadra, these bodhisattvas of compassion, living together, the Doshinji code, all of this is to bring forth this virtue, which we already possess as our basic nature. So we're not trying to fabricate something that is foreign to us. And what the Buddha says over and over and over again is he presents teachings in relationship to his, in essence, the Eightfold Path of right effort. To not cultivate what is unskillful, what is non-virtuous, when something has been brought forth, which is unskillful, to attend to it, to practice it, to calm it down, to let it go. And then to bring forth that which is virtuous, that which is skillful, that which is essential to the path. And then once it's arisen, to strengthen it so it remains more constant, more steady. The Buddha said, if there's no sense control, then the basis for virtue is destroyed. If there's no virtue, then the basis for right concentration is destroyed. So in the other text, he's drawing the relationship between virtue, concentration, and discernment. And discernment here means seeing things clearly, seeing things as they are, seeing things from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, to see the suffering in all things that are conditioned, to see that suffering as a result of our grasping and clinging, to see the possibility of cessation, of freedom from that suffering, and the path. So here the Buddha draws the connection between how we inhabit our senses and our concentration, which is both our mindfulness and our samadhi in Zazen. So he's drawing a direct link to how we live our lives, internally and externally, because virtue, of course, is the basis upon which we can be a benefit in the world. When we're not living that way, then that's how we create suffering. And so he says, when there's no sense control, and here we might think of sense control of just knowing how to live within a sentient, to live as a sentient being. So how do we, not just how do we see, because our eyes know how to see, not just how to hear, because our ears know how to hear, not how to think, because our mind knows how to think, it's built for that. But what do we do with what we see? How do we understand what we hear? How do we respond? What is our relationship to that which we see and hear and think and taste and touch and feel? Do we bring forth that which brings compassion and wisdom, patience and generosity? Or do we bring forth something else? So sense control, you know, control in our language and time is such a tricky word, because we think of control as a sort of a very tight fist, you know, to control things. And that's not what it means here. Control in Buddhism means to have gained the ability, in a sense, to be in charge. That when we want to bring our mind to one place, we can do that. In the beginning of Zazen, we can want to bring our mind to one place and not be able to do that. We can want to not follow an unhealthy desire and not be able to do that. So we don't have that kind of control, right? And so control here means being able to basically live as a practitioner, as an awakened being. And so it doesn't mean to block or suppress or deny or to criticize, because that only gives what we're perceiving through our senses more power, creates more sense of distance, more autonomy to that which we're seeing. If we have to react with aggressiveness or suppression, that's because we believe that what we're experiencing has to be conquered, has to be subdued. And so it just increases its weight. And so to have sense control means to understand, where does the power lie? When our mind is disrupted, what is disruption? He says the basis for virtue, for non-harming, for compassion is strengthened for the one who can practice well within their senses. So because all is non-dual, these divisions and boundaries that we can create in our mind are exactly that. Illusions we've created in our mind to create a sense of order and control. You know, as we compartmentalize and organize and name and describe the different aspects of ourself, of what we're experiencing, of everything, it creates a sense of control because we understand. But in fact, all things are interdependent, are intermingled, are mutually arising, mutually dependent. And so he's saying, when we don't live well, let's say when we don't live in accord with the precepts, concentration is going to be very difficult. When our concentration is very unsteady, to see clearly is going to be very difficult. It's not that we don't have the capacity, it's just going to be very difficult to have, we're not going to have easy access to that. The Buddha says, this is from one of the sutras, another sutra. He says, for one who is virtuous, who's practicing good, not creating harm, non-remorse will arise. For one free of remorse, gladness will arise, and this will lead to joy. Your body will become serene. You'll feel lightness, happiness, and your mind will be very easily in a state of concentration. And then he says, it's a natural law. It's a basic truth of human consciousness that for one with a concentrated mind to know and see things as they really are is a natural consequence. For one with a concentrated mind, it is a natural law that we will know and see things as they really are. So then the converse, of course, is when the mind is not concentrated, that law shows its other side. It's very difficult to know and see things as they are. We see and know things, right? It's not that we stop seeing and stop knowing, but what we know and see is not things as they are. They are things as they appear to be. And that's what we call delusion. And so here he draws this kind of wonderful, interrelatedness between what we do with our thoughts, words, and actions, very simply. What are the quality of our thoughts, the desires that arise, the intentions that we establish? How do those lead then into verbalizing, speaking to ourselves, speaking to others? And how does that then lead to actions? And that when we do that within the way, then we won't experience remorse, right? Because we're not doing things that create discord, disharmony, conflict. We're not turning against ourselves. Our intentions and our actions are in alignment. And so we don't have regret. We're not creating the stuff of regret. And when that's the state that we're in, then there's a natural sense of gladness. And gladness, remember, in Buddhism means to be delighted by or be enlivened by the good qualities of yourself and others. Right? So like when we're not feeling, think about, the precept on elevating the self and blaming others or speaking harshly of others. That usually when we really fall into that, it's because we don't feel good about something about ourselves. And so as a way of elevating that, right, picking ourselves up when we don't feel very good, we take somebody else and put them down, right? And that makes us feel, gives us a sense of feeling better. It's sort of a cardboard cake. You know, it doesn't really taste that good. But at that moment, we're not that picky, right? We just want a little pick me up. So we'll settle for that. And so gladness is, that's coming from feeling heavy, burdened, regretful, not good about ourselves. But when that's not there, when we feel a lightness of being, when we feel like we're living in accord with our intentions, which doesn't mean that everything is working out or that we're getting everything we want. It doesn't mean that. It just means that we're not in conflict. We're not living in conflict with ourselves and others for the most part. And so then there's a natural sort of joyfulness that arises because we're actually bringing forth our good qualities. And that feels good. And when that's happening, it's we much more naturally feel magnanimous, right? When we are feeling more sort of spacious and generous and within ourselves, it's very easy, much easier to feel generous towards others. And so we tend to notice the goodness in others. Whereas when we don't feel good about ourselves, so we go looking for the things we don't like in others. And so how all of this relates, and that gladness then leads to joy. And that then brings a kind of serenity into the body. So it's very interesting. So this is, we might think of this as, before this as mind and emotion. And now he says, now there's a direct connection with how you experience your physical being. Your body feels settled, right? So the lack of conflict in the mind brings forth a lack of conflict within the body. And so when we're, you know, when we're sitting and we feel a lot of tension or struggling or restlessness or dis-ease within our body, and we sort of focus on that physically, right, we have to remember that it's not separate from mind. Which means not only do we need to work with our minds to try and find that wakeful ease, but that dis-ease within our body is because there is dis-ease within our mind. They're not two. And so then with this feeling more stable and settled, more at ease within the body, then there's a natural kind of happiness that arises. And then this leads, the Buddha says, to concentration. The body is settled, the mind settles. And then, because it's a natural law of human consciousness, that then leads us to know and see things more clearly, to realize the nature of things. So when we find ourselves in our mind separating things, right, our meditation from our actions, so we think, you know, I'm really diligent in my meditation, but I'm hell on wheels once I get off the cushion. Watch out. Or I'm really, you know, a shining example off the cushion, but when I get onto the cushion, I like die or go to sleep or whatever. Do something at odds with that. Or they're separating our intention from the consequences of that intention, or inside from outside, wisdom come from compassion. So all of these ways that we think that, you know, we can get away with compartmentalizing. Like, yeah, I know I got to take care of this, but, you know, it's way over there. Like, I put it in a box, I've got a lid on it, right? You can't see it, right? Because it's a well-built box. Right? This is all part of the scheme. So I'll get to it. Or maybe not. Maybe I don't need to. Maybe I can be enlightened without getting to that. We'll see. So this idea that we can compartmentalize is just an idea. Right? It's a false idea. It's not true. We don't have the power to do that because that's not the way things are. That's not what we are. And so then it makes sense, the Buddha's teaching on the Eightfold Path, the Eight Gates of Zen. Why all these different aspects? Why not just one thing? Right? Because in being one thing, we have to approach that in many different ways. Because we have all of these aspects to our being, and they all have to be attended to. Now, having said all that, what the Buddha pointed to about remorse and trying to live in such a way that we don't create remorse, remorse itself is a very powerful force. Right? In many ways, it's has a very useful function if we use it well. And in a sense, that's sort of the key to learning how to be a practitioner of the Buddha Dharma, is how do we use things? We get so fixated on what is this happening or is this happening? Is there this or is there this? But we're largely not in control of that. And as soon as we've cleaned up one thing, there's another mess, and then there's another, and then there's another. And if we haven't created it, somebody else has. And so that's not the path to peace. The path to peace is knowing how to live peacefully, whatever the conditions. And so when something, we do something that brings forth remorse, that has a very important function. It brings our attention. It gets our attention because it's painful. And having gotten our attention, it brings us to the source of that remorse. What did I do? Who did I hurt? And then as a practitioner, that matters to me. Right? If that doesn't matter to me, then I'm further apart than everything. So if that doesn't matter to me, but it's still workable, because if it doesn't matter to me, then I can work at getting to the place where it does. Because nothing is ever actually not there. So although I may not care in this moment, my capacity to care is completely here and present. And so if I don't care, then I can work on caring. And of course, you know, one of the things that can be, you know, when we're causing sort of disrupt, when we have a lot of disruption within ourselves and we cause it outside of ourselves, that has to occupy us. And whether we avoid it, whether we indulge in it, or whether we practice it, either way, it occupies us. And so that then becomes sort of the primary focus. That's what we have to devote our energies to. You know, if you set the house on fire, and you only got one house and you can't leave it, you got to deal with fire, right? Now you can deny it's not burning. The house isn't burning, right? But it is, and so you still have to deal with it by denying it. And so then it becomes a kind of a black hole of our vital energies. So that's what our life force is being devoted to. And so when this teaching of the Buddha that leads from, you know, living rightfully in alignment, and then leads to, you know, non-remorse, gladness, joy, serenity in the body, concentration. That's just another way of saying that now all of our vital energies are going directly into aliveness, into living this life, experiencing this life in those ways, and enjoying this life. And so we see how our inner state becomes our outer state, how our way of understanding what we call ourselves is how we understand each other. A virtuous doesn't mean to be self-righteous, you know, to be like a saint. It means just to recognize, in a way, it means to recognize there are many paths a person can take, right? Part of our growing up is to be witness to so many different ways that people live their lives, right? As kids, you grow up, right? You see people who are older than you, you see the parents of your friends, you see adults all over the place. And as we get older, we see, oh, people are making these different kinds of choices. They're doing different things with their lives. Right? They're living in they're making different things priorities. They're deciding that different kinds of things are important. They're sort of establishing different things as the center of their life. That's what this person is focusing on. This is what they're devoting their life to. This is what they think is going to work. And as a person, just paying attention, we sort of have on display all of these different possible paths. Now, of course, they're not us. So if we were to make similar choices, we might find it working out a different way, but maybe not so different. And so we could think of virtuous. I think of virtuous as just recognizing that, then thoughtfully, conscientiously, sincerely reflecting on, okay, I have this life. That's one thing I know. I don't know how long, but I know I have it today. What do I want to do with it? Time swiftly passes by. How do we shift these deep currents of conditioned patterns? And because all things are codependent, the moment we begin practicing, we're practicing. That's it. That may not sound like a big deal. From your reaction, I'm guessing that it doesn't seem like a big deal. It's a big deal. What it means is the thing that we want to be doing, we're doing. The path that we want to be taking, that we have faith in, we're on it. We so often don't see it and don't appreciate it because we so want that fruit and that reward, and we want it now, and we want it to look like what we expect it to be. That's just that old mind trying to control, creating a different set of boundaries and boxes. That's the delusion box. I've got that taken care of. I'm tucking that away. This is my enlightenment box. The doors open. Fill her up. And it doesn't seem to be happening. What's going on? I thought I was doing it. I said you're doing it. Then why aren't you getting what you thought you were going to get? Free yourself of that mind. To have faith in the Dharma really means have faith in the Dharma, not your expectation. And so what it means is that the moment you begin practicing, you are practicing. It means that all of this that the Buddha is speaking about, all of your qualities, all of your karma, all of the possibilities, all that you are in this moment, a fully present enlightened nature, all that compassion is here. And it's being brought forth. But because these cycles are deep and strong, because these attachments are many and subtle, because our faith in our delusion and our attachments and our false views and our suffering is so strong, that when we let go and we hold on at the same time. The Buddha said, students, as long as you have conviction and remorse and concern and learning and arouse persistence and establish mindfulness and discernment, your growth can be expected. You will not decline. So in this sutra, the Mahapaninibbana Sutta, at the very beginning, there's this interesting section where an emissary of a king who's getting ready to go to war against another kingdom sends his emissary to the Buddha and basically says to the emissary, tell the Buddha that I'm going to war and see what he says. Kind of a curious mission. And so the Buddha takes a very interesting tact. He doesn't say, don't go to war, you know, that's a bad idea. He talks to Ananda, and he says, you know that kingdom, those people, that this king wants to go to war against? And Ananda says, yeah. And then he starts asking Ananda, have you noticed how they act in this way that is virtuous? And Ananda says, yeah, I've noticed that. Have you noticed that they do this, which is very good for establishing a healthy community? And Ananda says, yes, I've noticed that. And he goes through this whole sort of litany of good qualities of this kingdom that's getting ready to be warred upon. So that by the end, the emissary is like, I don't think we should go to war against them. Because they're like really healthy, and they like, we might lose. Because they're in really good shape. And the Buddha's like, whatever. And so then it's as though he gets an idea. I'm projecting. But it's as though he gets an idea, and he says to Ananda, call the monks. And he presents really this kind of the same model, but now presented towards the Sangha. That's what I read on Saturday. And that's more like how to keep the Sangha healthy, how to keep the Sangha from declining. But then he goes into a whole sequence of qualities, such as what I just read, which is really very directly related to you, your practice, individual practice. But of course, You know, remember, he's on his final days. So he's teaching, he wants to leave the Sangha with everything he can so that they will hang together, right? That the Dharma will continue. And so he says, as long as you have conviction, which means resolve, commitment, that you have reflected on what is important. And the Buddha says, when it's deeply rooted, well embedded, immovable, unshakable, then it is like a protection, right? A protection from being, you know, pushed around by your internal and our external world. Because even when we are pushed around, we have that conviction. I know what my path is. I know what I want to apply myself to. I know what to return to. I know what to take refuge in. I know what I want my life to be about. Remorse is that having conviction, having that resolve, then when I experience remorse, I can hold that. Right? Because that regret, that action that caused that regret is not in a void. It's not floating somewhere. I'm not floating somewhere. That exists within this sense of conviction. And so I have a sense of, okay, so I've done this, I feel the regret, this is what I need to do. I need to practice it. I need to take responsibility. I need to address the harm that I have done. I need to study that path that took me in that direction so that I learn from it. And here the Buddha says, the disciple of the noble ones abandons what is unskillful, develops what is skillful, abandons what is blameworthy and develops what is blameless, and looks after herself with a clear mind. And then concern. As long as we have conviction and remorse and concern, the Buddha says that the student feels concern for the suffering that results from acting badly with my body, with my words, with my mind. That concerns me. That matters, right? That's what my conviction is about. My conviction is to live in a different way. I am concerned at falling away from the path. That concerns me. I don't want to do that. So that means I want to do everything I need to stay on the path. And then learning, which in this case means to listen to the Dharma, to come back to it over and over and over again, to study it, to examine it, to reflect on it, to develop faith in it, to put it into practice, to apply it, right? To verify it. Is it true? The Buddha says it's true. Is it true? You have to know. I have to know. And again, how all of this is connected. It starts with that resolve. And then when there's remorse, right, I can hold that. And that brings forth the great concern. And then I learn. And so when I realize, oh, there's a gap, there's a blindness, there's an indulgence, there's something that I'm not seeing, right? I have a path. Hallelujah. I mean, in a sense, I feel like when we really understand that, then unless, except for the moments we forget, we don't fall into despair. In my own early training, the moments when I fall into despair is when I forgot I had a path, which usually happened right on this cushion, right in the middle of session. When I'm immersed in it, I would forget. Right? Because in that mind, it was like, oh, there's nothing I can do. Right? And it was like, hang on. Wrong. There is something I can do. Do it. And then persistence. And again, the Buddha says, the noble ones keeps their persistence aroused for what? for abandoning unskillful mental qualities and bringing forth skillful mental qualities. So the Buddha really grounded his teachings, really emphasized. He didn't say, don't do the wrong thing. Don't do the right thing. He said, do what is skillful. But of course, that assumes that there's a basis for skillfulness. Skillfulness according to what? According to liberation. Be skillful in mental qualities that bring forth non-remorse, gladness, serenity in the body, concentration, which then feeds into our mindfulness. The Buddha says, a disciple of the noble ones is mindful, highly meticulous, attentive. Attentive. That's all. It's not heavy-handed. It's not rigid. It's not militaristic. It's just awake. It's awake. Remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said a long time ago. Because sati, mindfulness, what is translated as mindfulness, means primarily to remember. And so in that moment of bringing forth an unskillful mental quality, I remember, oh, this is a cycle. Right? I've been here many, many, many times. I know what happens when I do this, when I indulge it. I know what happens when I suppress it. I also know what happens when I don't. And so we bring to mind what we have learned, what we've experienced, what we've already discovered to be true. Because even though we have experienced that to be true, we forget. And so we have to remember again and then practice it again and then verify it again, make it real, not just a memory. And then it becomes a little bit more sort of integrated. And then we forget. And then we have to remember again and bring it into practice and remember that in our bodies. And then we forget again and again and again until we don't forget. And that allows us to have discernment, to see things as they are, to see what is arising, to see what is passing, to know our mind, to be familiar with our cycles, so that when they arise, we can bring forth detachment, dispassion, disenchantment, these different ways that the Buddha spoke of not being dragged in, right? Not believing in. It arises, it has power, but I do not believe. Remember the Buddha's tomorrow over and over and over again. I know you. That was his moment of mindfulness. I know you. We have met before. We have had this conversation before. I am not fooled by you anymore. He says, then the Buddha went to the assembly hall and sat down on the seat laid out. And then he addressed the students. These qualities that I have taught, having known them directly, having realized them myself, you now should practice them and grasp them thoroughly, cultivate them, develop them, and pursue them so that this life may long endure and remain steadfast for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of the multitude. Out of deep compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of human beings and all beings. Having discovered these things to be true, because the Buddha says, because I discovered them to be true, you can discover them to be true. Because in that, we are not different. We are the same. And then so that to practice them, cultivate them, strengthen them, develop them so that this life within the way may long endure for you in your life and remain steadfast, steady, stable, that it ceases to be even a matter of when you turn towards it, there it is, because you realize you can't turn away. That the idea of turning away simply means there's more that needs to be practiced and understood. The very idea of being able to lose our way can itself be realized as not true. And why? For the benefit, welfare, and happiness of the multitude. And then the Buddha said, I exhort you, I urge you, I implore you. All fabrications, everything that you experience, is subject to decay. You cannot hold on to it. You cannot rely upon it. Reach consummation through heedfulness. Reach fulfillment. Discover your own Buddha nature, its completeness, through being heedful. Be diligent, meticulous. Trust all that has brought you this far. We cannot rely on the ever-changing world because it's ever-changing. That's why the Buddha realized liberation has to be based in what is not changing, what you cannot lose, what can never betray, what cannot be corrupted, what is not created. Because of that, you cannot possess it, grasp it. And realizing that eternal truth, eternal nature, then living in this ever-changing world holds that promise of joy and gladness, serenity. And it is a path, which means simply at every moment, there's practice. At every moment, we're standing in that threshold. And Sesshin is just leaping through that threshold, developing all of these tremendously powerful, wondrous qualities. And having faith in the Dharma, and faith in yourself. Those have to work together. You know, if you really have faith in the Dharma, but you don't have faith in yourself, it has power, but you don't. If you have faith in yourself, but not the Dharma, you have power, but so what? What are you going to do with it? Where will you direct it? So faith in both self-nature and the nature of the Dharma is essential. And so that's part of what we're developing. And is developing in the moments, no matter what we may think, no matter how difficult it may be, when we just engage it as practice. So don't get hung up on the results. Trust the path. Getting hung up on the results means we're standing back, measuring, comparing, analyzing, and losing, generally. Coming up short. But you know, in that same moment, when you just turn back and you just engage it, then that whole system drops away and you're just climbing that mountain.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.